Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour so that you can call in and ask questions about the Bible or the Christian faith if you're interested. We'll be glad to talk to you if you see things differently than the host and want to, you know, talk about an alternate viewpoint about something. Feel free to call about that too. Right now our lines are full, but they will not be constantly full. We have them opening up throughout the whole program. So if you have this number, you can call in you know, randomly anytime in the next few minutes or beyond, and you may find a line has opened for you. So you'll need to have this number. It's 844-484-5737. That number again is 844-484-5737. And we're going to go directly to the phones today and talk to Steve from Lakewood, California. Hey, Steve, welcome.
Yeah, welcome. Thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate it. Sure. Quick comment before my concise question. You know, I've heard one of your messages, your lectures on hell, three Christian views. I recently saw your interview with these other two gentlemen the other day. That was a great hour and a half. I appreciate that. And, you know, like you, I was brought up in the Christian church, believing in eternal conscious torment. I don't have any problems leaving that position, although I'm like you, I'm undecided still. But, you know, what I'm really having a problem with is universal reconciliation. I could accept annihilationism, but universal reconciliation really gives me some problems. But here's my question. In Mark 9:44 through Mark 9:48, I know you're very familiar with these passages. Sure. Jesus says three times to be cast into hell, into the fire that never quenches, where the worm, and he personalizes it, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. So my question is, three times he mentions cast into hell, six times he mentions fire that is not quenched, also along with the worm that never dies. So how can any scriptural evidence, even though it's in greater support of the other two positions, how can it cancel out and trump what Jesus said in Mark 9?
Yeah, nothing can trump what Jesus said anywhere. Jesus is the final authority on all subjects. The question is, what did Jesus say? I mean, we have English translations, which render it a certain way, but we also have the Greek, which really the English translations do their best to translate. And the translators have to make their own decisions about things. Now, the main thing, I think, that needs to be, the translation of which needs to be looked at differently, is that he didn't use the word hell, because the word hell doesn't appear in the Greek language. He used, in this case, the word Gehenna. Now, there's other Greek words, like Hades and Sheol and even Tartarus, that are translated by the English word hell in the King James Version. But only Jesus used the term Gehenna as a reference to, you know, punishment. Now, James also used the word Gehenna, but he didn't refer to it as a place of punishment. He just said that the tongue is set on fire from Gehenna. So he's not talking about, he's just talking about the source of our problems with our tongue is Gehenna, but not sure exactly how he meant that. But apart from James' one statement, the only person in the Bible that used the word Gehenna to speak of punishment is Jesus. And Gehenna means the Valley of Hinnom. Now, that's the actual translation of the Greek word, Gehenna. It literally means Valley of Hinnom. And that's a geographical place outside of Jerusalem. There's a valley called the Valley of Hinnom. And it's mentioned in the Old Testament. Interestingly, it's mentioned by Jeremiah as a place where the dead bodies of the wicked Jews will be thrown in a mass, you know, sort of a mass burial, only without burying, and just throw them into a valley. When the Babylonians would destroy Jerusalem in 586 B.C., Jeremiah twice talks about how the Valley of Hinnom will become the Valley of the Slaughter because of the multitude of the dead that will be thrown into there when the Babylonians come and just massacre the Jews and wipe out Jerusalem. Now, Jesus also was talking to a generation of Jews that were going to face a massacre and the destruction of Jerusalem. He actually said so. He said it would happen in their generation. And he said that the Jews who were listening to him, if they didn't come to him, the other option was they're going to be thrown into Gehenna. That is the Valley of Hinnom. Now, that would suggest that the Valley of Hinnom was functioning in the teaching of Jesus the same way it functioned in the teaching of Jeremiah. Namely, both generations, Jeremiah's and Jesus's, were facing almost immediate destruction at the hands of invaders who would wipe people out, burn down the city, destroy the temple, and cast great numbers of dead corpses into the Valley of Hinnom right outside Jerusalem. And anyone who's been to Jerusalem probably has visited Gehenna. I've walked through Gehenna. It's obviously still there. Valleys don't go anywhere. So it's, you know, that happened. That happened. Now, why do any translators translate Gehenna as hell? Well, I think following the rabbis in this, and rather than following, say, Jeremiah's lead, Jeremiah basically provides an earlier precedent for the use of Gehenna as a place of punishment or of corpses being piled there. But the rabbis, much later than Jeremiah's time, used the word Gehenna to speak of the afterlife, of the place of punishment of people in the afterlife. They believe that people who are wicked, when they die, will go to Gehenna, and they'll suffer there for 12 months. Now, they believe that after 12 months, they'll either be restored to God, or they'll be burned up and annihilated. And a very few rabbis thought maybe they'd be there forever, but mostly the rabbis taught that Gehenna was a place where people go for 12 months after they die. Now, this idea is not sponsored anywhere by biblical writers, including Jesus. And so, however, because many Jewish rabbis in Jesus' day used the word Gehenna to speak of a post-mortem punishment of sinners, it is assumed that Jesus probably just followed their lead, that Jesus just got his language from the rabbis, and therefore he's talking about the post-mortem place of judgment, hell, that people will go to after they die. My thought is that Jesus is much more likely to use the language the way the inspired prophets used it, like Jeremiah, than the way the uninspired rabbis used it, which he didn't have much respect for. They were the Pharisees, of course. And so he seems to be saying that if people reject him, that is the Jews, because he was only speaking to Palestinian Jews. Paul, who wrote to Gentiles and preached to Gentiles, and Peter also, who preached to Gentiles, they never used the word Gehenna anywhere. But that's because the Gentiles were not in danger of being thrown into the Valley of Hinnom in AD 70, as the Jews were. But again, Jesus speaking like Jeremiah did of his own times, that Jerusalem's would be destroyed, the casualties would be thrown into Gehenna, that is the Valley of Hinnom, is talking, I believe, about the end of the temple and the Jewish system when the Romans would come and wipe people out and cast their bodies aside into the valley. So Jesus, I don't think, is talking about hell at all. The fact that English translators have used the word hell means they're following a tradition that began in the early English translational period, and that they're assuming that Gehenna to Jesus meant the same thing it meant to the rabbis, rather than what it meant to Jeremiah and Isaiah, who both spoke of Gehenna. Now, Isaiah did too, and Isaiah, although he didn't use the word Gehenna, he did describe Gehenna in Isaiah chapter 66. Now, if you'll check out Isaiah 66, the last words in the book of Isaiah are the words that Jesus is quoting in Mark 9, the passage you raised. In Isaiah 66, 24, it says that the righteous will go forth and look upon the corpses of the men who have transgressed against me, for their worm does not die, and their fire is not quenched, and they shall be an abhorrence to all flesh. Now, this is not talking about, you know, people who are suffering in hell. This is talking about corpses, dead bodies. And it says the righteous will go out and look at these corpses out there. And it says their worm does not die and their fire is not quenched. Now, Jesus used those lines, their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched, to speak of, as he put it, Gehenna. In other words, he's quoting Isaiah, and he's identifying what Isaiah is talking about as Gehenna, which again is the Valley of Hinnom. And he's not, Isaiah doesn't describe an after-death experience. He's talking about corpses whose bodies are being burned and eaten by worms. And so there's not really any good reason to see this as a reference to hell except tradition. And I think in many cases, traditions need to be challenged because they simply don't go along with what the Bible is saying. So Regardless what we think about which view of hell is correct, even if we believe in eternal conscious torment, well, this verse doesn't support that, because the persons in question are not conscious. They're corpses. Corpses are by definition dead. And therefore, we're not talking about living people suffering forever, although the fires keep burning. There are many who believe that Gehenna in the time of Christ, or at least after the fall of Jerusalem, was used as a dump, and that things were burned there, and they kept the fires burning continually. And some feel that that's why this language of the fires not quenched is used. However, if you'd simply look up the word quenched in a concordance, you'll find that Jeremiah especially, and other prophets too, but Jeremiah mostly, used the word unquenchable fire, or fire that cannot be quenched, or fire that no one can quench. This language is used many times in Jeremiah, in every case when he's talking about the Babylonians destroying Jerusalem and burning down the temple. That is, every reference to unquenchable fire in Jeremiah is a reference to a judgment that came on Jerusalem, and it was God's wrath that was the unquenchable fire. And the suffering, of course, was not in the form of fire that burned forever and ever and ever and ever, because, of course, that fire that burned up Jerusalem in 586 BC isn't still burning. But the idea is it was language common in Jeremiah. And Jesus was very much like Jeremiah. He's speaking to the last generation of people in Jerusalem before it was going to be destroyed. And he's warning them, it's going to be destroyed, just like it was in the days of Jeremiah, just like Jeremiah spoke of it as the wrath of God's unquenchable fire coming on them. So this is also the unquenchable fire. And Isaiah used the term also. So I think worms that don't die is probably simply just like unquenchable fire. It's impressionistic. Now, by the way, unquenchable fire doesn't mean fire that doesn't ever go out. It's fire that can't be quenched or put out. You see, people can build a fire and they can throw water on it and quench it. You can light a candle and you can snuff it. That's quenching a fire. A fire that cannot be quenched is a fire that nobody can put out. But it doesn't mean it's a fire that will never burn out. Every large forest fire in ancient times was an unquenchable fire because nobody had the technology to put it out. They just had to let it burn out. The point here is that an unquenchable fire is not necessarily one that never goes out, or an eternal fire. And he doesn't mention anything about an eternal fire here. So this leaves open the question, is he even talking about hell, or is he talking about the judgment that came upon his very listeners within 40 years of that time when the Romans came and destroyed Jerusalem? The more familiar you become with the Old Testament prophets and the language they used, the more you'll be familiar with the language Jesus used, because he was a Jew too and a prophet, speaking to Jewish people who did know the Old Testament prophets a lot better than most Christians do. And the more you're aware of the language that Jesus used and the prophets used, the more you can make some sense out of what Jesus said. And it's usually going to be different sense than is made by people who simply ignore Jewish idioms and who think that they're, you know, that Jesus wanted us as American Western 21st century people to understand such images the way that modern Western writers would use them. We're much better equipped to understand what Jesus meant if we understand what the Jews, how they talked and how Jesus talked to them, because he used the language they used. And that's why I don't think that this passage in any sense is a slam dunk for any view of hell. I'm not even sure it's about hell. But if it is about hell, the only thing we can say about it, the only thing immortal in it, is the worms. According to Isaiah, the humans are dead corpses. So there's no immortal people burning there. There's only immortal worms. And I think it's a favorite passage for those who want to prove a certain doctrine of hell. I have a book, by the way, I wrote called Why Hell, which actually examines every passage in the entire Bible that people use to talk about hell. And it compares three different views, like the lecture you heard of mine does, compares three views. And I don't advocate any one of them, but it may help you understand some of these verses that people just, off the top of their head, they say, oh, this proves eternal torment. Well, until you look at it, it does. Until you look at the Old Testament verses it's quoting, it does. And before you look at the idioms that were commonplace to his Jewish listeners, it does. But see, yeah, when we're just English-speaking people reading an English translation and it says things like ours say, yeah, it does kind of sound like it supports the traditional view. But that's because the translators themselves believed in the traditional view, and therefore they rendered the words in a way that supported that view. And they assumed it was about hell. But frankly, I don't think there's any excellent reason to believe that Jesus is talking about hell there at all. Anyway, I hope that's helpful. If not, you might want to look at my book on the subject, Why Hell? Three Christian Views Critically Examined. You can get that from Amazon if you want to. There's also an Audible version of it and a Kindle version of it. Okay, let's talk to Peter from the United Kingdom. Hi, Peter. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Growing up, I grew up in Christian circles where it was believed that a Christian could experience a curse, whether that's a generational curse or curse if you don't tithe, or if someone such as like a pastor, for example, like a pastor could pronounce a curse on someone. Now, I've always believed that Christians cannot be cursed based on Galatians 3, where it talks about Christ redeeming us from the curse of the law. However, I still meet Christians that believe that a Christian can be cursed. And I was just curious to know what your thoughts are if Christians can be cursed.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. I mean, Paul did say, if anyone preaches any other gospel than that which I preach, let him be accursed. And he also, that of course, in Galatians 1, 8, and then also in 1 Corinthians 16:22, he said, if anyone does not love our Lord Jesus Christ, let him be accursed. But it could be argued that those are not Christians. People who preach a false gospel and people who don't love the Lord are apparently not really Christians at all. And Paul does pronounce curses on them. Now, I don't think Paul would ever pronounce a curse on Christians. Jesus said, bless those who curse you. So for us to curse other people would seemingly be disobedient to Christ. We should, even if they're cursing us, we should bless them. Now, Ken, what if someone curses us? Well, there is a verse in Proverbs. I'm sorry, I would have to look it up. But it says something like, as a sparrow flying, so a curse that is uncaused, I think King James says a curse causeless, shall not alight. In other words, it's saying that if a curse is uttered against somebody, it's Proverbs 26:2. My wife, who's here in the room, just informed me. Proverbs 26:2, that just like a bird flying, a curse will not light on somebody that doesn't deserve it. So I mean, God can curse people, but He doesn't want to. You know, He's not eager to curse people. And if you're living a holy life and obedient to Him and you love Him, He wouldn't have any interest in cursing you. I don't think a pastor can put a curse on you. Now, if a pastor says, if you don't pay your tithes, you're cursed with a curse, because Malachi chapter 3 tells us that if you don't tithe, you're cursed with a curse. Well, that was back when people were required to tithe. Obviously, God did pronounce many curses on Israel if they violated His law. I mean, Deuteronomy 28:15 to the end of the chapters, dozens of curses. Cursed are you, if you disobey me, that you'll be cursed in this way and cursed in that way and cursed in this way and cursed in that way. So, I mean, there are curses that come on human beings for their disobedience. They bring them upon themselves. It might be even thought that God brings them upon them. If so, it'd be as a disciplinary action. But for a pastor to say, I'm going to curse you, or to say that you're cursed because you don't keep the Jewish law, which tithing is a part of that. Sure, I mean, Malachi was writing to people under the law, and they were breaking that law, and he said, you're cursed. But, I don't know, I can't think of any situation in which a Christian, certainly not a pastor, could legitimately utter curses against somebody. So, if that's, and would they matter if they did? I mean, if somebody wrongfully uttered a curse against me, my only concern would be does God agree with them? If I'm innocent, if I'm serving God, somebody just doesn't like what I'm doing, or they don't like me, and so they utter a curse against me. To me, that's their problem, not mine, because God's not going to curse me just because they want Him to. And to say, well, it has nothing to do with God. It has to do with you know, mystical powers of a curse being brought upon you. Generational curses are obviously that kind of thing that people think they believe is taught in the Bible. The Bible, you know, there may be curses. I mean, witches and stuff place curses on people, but putting curses on people, when we're not talking about, you know, God's curse on them, that's magic. I mean, that's like saying I have the supernatural power to ruin your life by saying certain magical words, like I curse you in this way. Now, if God has put a curse on somebody because they're evil and disobedient and so forth, then, of course, people can live under that curse or die under that curse. But God is not God's not the type who really would take delight in cursing anyone, and although he has put a curse on some because they're evil. But a Christian wouldn't have to worry about that. God won't do that. And I don't think anybody else has the magical power to do so either. That's what I think Solomon means when he says a curse uncaused will not alight.
Yeah, I think it's because I grew up in a word of faith sort of environment where...
Yeah, word of faith. Know, word of faith is all about magic. Yeah, it's all about magical powers. Yeah. You just say the words and magical things happen. That's the word of faith teaching. It's not biblical. It's superstitious.
And just very quickly, Steve, in terms of generational curses, I've always believed that, I mean, you're responsible only for what you've done. And would you say, is it unbiblical to say that, oh, because of something that your parents or grandparents did, that's what's affecting you now? Or
Right. God makes it very clear. Yeah. God makes it very clear in Ezekiel 18 and elsewhere in Ezekiel that a child will not suffer for the crimes of his parents. You see, the Jewish people in Ezekiel's day were saying, they had this proverb. They said the fathers have eaten the sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. Meaning that, you know, if you eat a grape and it turns out to be sour, you kind of grimace and set your teeth on edge. It's saying, well, our teeth are set on edge, but we didn't eat the sour grapes. Our parents did. So that was it's like saying our parents did the bad thing and we're the ones suffering the consequence of it. That was the proverb. The fathers have eaten the sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. That's kind of the doctrine of generational curses. You know, my parents did the bad thing and now I'm suffering. Well, it is possible, of course, for children to suffer for bad decisions their parents make. I mean, many children are abused by their parents. Those are bad decisions their parents are making. Many children go hungry because their parents waste their money on gambling or laziness, you know. I mean, many choices parents can make can bring hardship misfortune, I say, on their children. But that's not some mystical thing. That's not like, well, God is mad at my dad, so he's taken it out on me. No, God never does that. God actually rebukes them for saying that proverb about the fathers have eaten the sour grapes and the children's teeth. He says, don't ever say that. That's not true. The father will not suffer for his children's sins. The children won't suffer for their parents' sins. Now, by saying that children won't suffer for their parents' sins, he means not at God's hand. God's not going to punish the children. But, I mean, the father may bring a curse on his children simply if by a curse we mean, let's say, poverty. Is there a father, by his stupidity and evil, can bring poverty on his whole family? No question about that. But that doesn't reflect anything about God's attitude toward the children. That's just, the father has power to do that kind of thing, but it's not supernatural. And like if a person's a drug addict and they get pregnant, it's possible their children will be born drug addicts. But God doesn't hold the child accountable for that. Yeah, the child is suffering, we might say, a curse, not a supernatural curse, just an ordinary misfortune because the parents did the wrong thing. But this doesn't reflect at all on God's attitude toward the children. So, no, I don't believe in generational curses, neither does the Bible.
Yeah. Thank you very much for clarifying that, Steve. Yeah, great to talk to you again. Thanks for taking the time to answer my question.
Well, it's always good to hear from you, Peter, and I hope things are going well for you there in the UK.
Yeah, the new sort of elections have happened, but yeah, it's what can we do? So not looking great.
We've got one coming up too, and it doesn't look all that good sometimes. Yeah, fortunately, God is the King of the Kings. Yeah, All right. God bless you, too. Good talking to you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Well, we still have a lot of people waiting online, but we have a break at the bottom of the hour, which we're taking right now, and we'll be having another half hour immediately after this short break, where we'll be taking calls again for the remainder of our time. During this break, we'd just like to let people know that The Narrow Path is a listener-supported program. You may notice there's no commercials. Nothing is for sale here. We have no sponsors. We're entirely supported by free will gifts from people, maybe like yourself, who would like to see us pay our radio bills and stay on the air. If you'd like to do that, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Now, you don't have to do it through the mail. If you want to help us out, it's possible to donate online. You just go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com, and you'll see there a donations opportunity and a lot of resources, which are all free. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Don't go away. We have another half hour.
Tell your family, tell your friends, tell everyone you know about the Bible radio show that has nothing to sell you but everything to give you. And that's The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. When today's radio show is over, go to your social media and send a link to thenarrowpath.com where everyone can find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. And tell them to listen live right here on the radio. Thank you for sharing listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, we'll be glad to talk to you. Right now, our lines are full, but if you want to try in a few minutes, you may find a line opens up for you before the show is over. The number to call will be and is 844-484-5737. And we're going to talk next to Joe calling from Los Angeles. Hello, Joe. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, Steve. I have two questions. One's a little funny, but see if we can give it a shot to answer it. So people that watch, I don't never watch that cartoon, The Simpsons, but I know there's a lot of people in the social media sharing how The Simpsons somehow are able to predict, you know, especially stuff that's going on, like with the elections and stuff like that. Donald Trump coming down the escalator when he first declared himself a candidate. What do you think about that? Have you heard anything about those kind of things?
Well, I think we have to conclude that the Rothschilds are watching The Simpsons to get their world dominion plan going, huh?
Yeah, that's...
No, I don't. No, I don't. I don't believe that. I think
it's
that...
It's a little bit of a mind-blower, you know?
Yeah, I don't think there's any prophecy or, you know, fortune-telling going on, and I don't think that The Simpsons are a secret, avenue through which the Illuminati are making known to the in code, you know, what they're going to do next. I just have to see it as a coincidence. Maybe it's something more, but I have no reason to believe it's anything else than that.
Oh, okay. So the other question I had was in 2 Peter 2:1, where it talks about the false prophets, and I just read it. I'll read it really quick. But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies and even denying the Lord who bought them and bring on themselves swift destruction. Doesn't that give you the indication that eternal security or, you know, you can never lose your salvation, whatever the case, that speaks against it completely?
It's interesting because it says they will deny the Lord who bought them, which means he died for them. And there are two doctrines held by the Calvinists which cannot both be true if this scripture is true. One doctrine they hold is that if you are truly the elect, then you will not fall away. Okay, they believe in perseverance of the saints. So if they would have to say, if these people are really Christians, really elect, then they would not fall away, which would mean they're not elect if they did, if they fall, if they've betrayed the Lord who bought them. But the problem is, if these people are not of the elect, then Calvinism also teaches that Jesus didn't die for anybody except the elect. Only the elect are the objects of his intention in dying. And yet these are people that Christ bought. It says they deny the Lord, which would mean they're not saved, who bought them, which means he paid for them. Which means you either have to deny the limited atonement of Calvinism and say, okay, they weren't bought by him because they're not elect. Or you have to deny perseverance of the saints, because if they were bought and they are elect, yet they denied him, which means they didn't persevere. So this one verse is a serious problem, I believe, to Calvinism. And it does certainly suggest that they can fall away. Now, Peter doesn't necessarily tell us that these people were saved before they denied the Lord. But the Bible does indicate that denying the Lord is a real danger for Christians, because Paul, when he was writing to Timothy, and by the way, Paul happened to be a Christian, and Timothy, he was quite sure, was also a Christian. And yet he said to Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:11, this is a faithful saying, as you can trust this one. If we died with him, we shall also live with him. If we endure, we shall also reign with him. If we deny him, he also will deny us. Now, Paul and Timothy are both Christians. Paul's writing to Timothy, and he uses the word us, which means at least him. He may mean the whole church, but it at least includes, when you say us, you at least mean yourself and the other person you're talking to. And he's saying, if we deny him, he will deny us. Now, some might say, well, that's hypothetical. A real Christian can't deny Christ. Well, I guess Paul just had a lot of surplus ink and space on his parchment. He just thought he'd fill in some words that didn't make any difference or any sense. Or not. Or Paul really did believe that if a Christian denies Christ, that Christ will deny him. It was, after all, the disciples of Jesus that Jesus was speaking to in Matthew chapter 10 when he said, whoever denies me, I will deny before my Father. And whoever confesses me before men, I will confess before my Father. He's basically sending his disciples out on an outreach where they will be persecuted and therefore be tempted to back away and maybe deny Christ under persecution. Well, if you do that, I'll deny you too. There's no suggestion in the Bible that a true Christian cannot fall away, cannot deny Christ, cannot, as you've put it, lose his salvation, or I would say apostatize. I believe that they can. I think all Christians can apostatize. So, but I don't think all Christians do, and I don't think we have to worry that we will. If we're taking Jesus seriously, I can't imagine how we would do it. But if we get slack, if we start loving the things of the world and more than God, well, of course, if we love our own lives more than we love God, then we may, under threats of death or torture, we may deny him. Well, that's our fault. Nobody's fault but our own. And we don't have to do that. So we never have to be insecure, like, oh my, what if I'm going to fall away? Well, just don't. That's up to you. God's not going to make you fall away. And the devil can't make you fall away. Nothing can separate you from the love of Christ. The devil can't. The demons can't. But you can walk away from him. The Bible makes that very clear. People do. And so these people that Peter refers to are denying the Lord who bought them. The fact that he bought them either means they were Christians who fell away and denied the Lord, or that Jesus bought everybody, but some never come to him and some never become his followers, and these are them that they deny him. So I think you're on to something. I think that verse definitely is a troublesome verse for Calvinism, because one of those two doctrines cannot be true. I frankly don't think either of the two doctrines are true, but they can both be wrong, but they can't both be right. So thank you for that observation. Damien from Orange County, California. Welcome.
Hey, Steve. So I have a question. So in Genesis 20, God tells Abimelech that it was him who kept him from committing sin against God.
Right.
And Calvinists often use this verse to support their determinism. How would you respond?
I would respond that I can take that verse completely at face value and say that God prevented Abimelech from sleeping with Sarah. Now, how did he do that? Well, by warning Abimelech before he slept with her. He had taken her into his harem, but he had not slept with her yet. And God appeared to him in a dream and told him, you know, you've got another man's wife. And Abimelech didn't know that. He didn't know Sarah was married to Abraham. And when he heard it, he said, oh, I didn't know that. And God says, I know. I knew you did it in the innocency of your heart. Therefore, I prevented you from sinning in this manner. In other words, he didn't let the man go through with committing adultery because he knew the man didn't intend to. And God mercifully kept him from falling into that terrible sin. Now, you don't have to be a Calvinist to believe that God prevents many sins from taking place. You know, in the book of Acts, the Bible says there were 40 evil men who took an oath that they would not eat or drink until they killed Paul. Okay, but did they kill Paul? Actually, they didn't. Paul got away, and they never killed him. He lived years after that. So I don't know if they broke their oath and ate and drank or they died of starvation, but they were determined to do the wrong thing. Now, Abimelech wasn't determined to do any wrong thing. He, as far as he knew, Sarah was available to be married, and he wanted to marry her. He was not aware of doing anything wrong. But because it would have been wrong, and because God didn't want Sarah to be defiled in this way, and God was protecting Abraham's interests, simply God interfered with that and alerted Abimelech. No, you can't do that. You're going to suffer if you do that. So Abimelech didn't do it. Likewise, in the case of the men who wanted to kill Paul, they deliberately were choosing to do evil, and yet God prevented that too. Actually, what happened is providentially, Paul's nephew overheard the plot and reported it to the police, and the police report it to the governor, and the governor whisks Paul away to safety somewhere else, and he never was delivered over to them. So God works in situations to prevent certain sins from taking place. In the book of Esther, Haman, a very wicked man, intended to hang Mordecai, a righteous man, on the gallows, and built a gallows for that purpose. But God intervened through a complex set of providences that we read about. That's what the whole book of Esther is largely about. How that God worked in the situation to make it so that instead of Mordecai being hanged on the gallows, Haman, who intended to hang Mordecai on the gallows, Haman got hung on the gallows. So, I mean, God is sovereign in the sense that he doesn't have to allow anything to happen if he doesn't want it to happen. But that doesn't mean he prevents everything from happening that he doesn't like. There's many things he doesn't like. He didn't like the fact that the children of Israel worshipped a golden calf. He didn't like that at all. He didn't like the fact that Israel kept lapsing into idolatry. He didn't like the fact that David committed adultery and murdered Uriah. He didn't like those things. God doesn't like sin, and he'd rather people didn't do it, but he doesn't always intervene to prevent it. But there are times when something that God cares about enough is at stake. They'll say, well, you know, there's people plotting to do wrong here, but I'm just not going to let them do it. You know, I'm going to stop it from happening because that would go too much against my purposes and my preferences in this matter. So God can intervene anytime he wants to stop human actions. And he even if he has to strike them dead, that's no difficulty for him. In Psalm 21, verse 11, David is talking about certain evil people who were opposed to God. And it says in Psalm 21:11, for they intended evil against you. They devised a plot which they are not able to perform. Now, the strong indication is they're not able to perform it because God doesn't permit it. These people had plotted against God, but they found themselves incapable of carrying it out. Why? Because God didn't want that plot to happen. On the other hand, when people wanted to destroy Job, God kept them from doing that until a time came when he wanted to test Job. And then he gave permission to the devil to bring harm on Job that God was protecting Job from previously. So we see, we can be quite sure of this. Wherever our trials come from, even if people who are evil and not obedient to God are bringing our trials to us, what is happening to us is something that God, if he wishes, could prevent. And the fact that he did not prevent it is not because he's taken a nap like Baal was thought to be when he wasn't answering the prophets of Baal. Maybe he's taking a nap. Maybe he's on a journey. Well, God doesn't go on journeys and take naps, and he's never indisposed. He always knows what's going on with you. The hairs of your head are numbered, Jesus said. He said, not even a sparrow falls to the ground and dies without God's permission. And how much are you worth to God more than sparrows? In other words, not the slightest detail can go wrong in your life unless God lets it. And he may, because troubles in our lives are sometimes what God intends to use for our good. But the thing is, we can always be sure that nothing accidentally has occurred to us to ruin our lives, because God's around. He's paying attention. He knows how many hairs are on your head. And he certainly knows if somebody's plotting to do you harm. And he knows how to stop them if he wants to. And the fact that he doesn't stop them in any given case means that he intends this for our good. So, you know, Joseph's brothers tried to kill him and wanted to kill him probably from his earliest youth. They hated him. But on one occasion, God allowed them to capture him and take him into slavery and sell him into slavery. Now, that's not a good thing. From Joseph's point of view, he didn't think it was a good thing, but God allowed it. He didn't protect Joseph on that occasion. And what happened? Good things happened eventually. Joseph suffered for decades, but in the end, he said, you know, to his brothers, you intended evil against me, but God meant it for good, to save many lives as it is this day. So God allowed something, you know, really bad to happen to Joseph that he had always previously prevented his brothers from doing, but this time there was a purpose in it, a good purpose, and Joseph knew it. Same thing when Jesus was, opposed by the Pharisees. They often took up stones to stone him, but Jesus walked through and they didn't touch him. And the Bible says, because it was not yet his hour. His hour had not come. In other words, God wasn't willing for him to die yet. It wasn't time. And so no matter how many people plotted to kill him, took up stones to throw, tried to throw him off a cliff in Nazareth, no matter how many people did that, Jesus walked free until it was his time. And it says in Acts chapter 2 that when Jesus did die, it was because God delivered him over to those that wanted to kill him. In other words, God didn't protect him like he had before. And of course, the reason God didn't is because God had a good thing to come from Jesus dying and resurrecting. So the point here is, yeah, God can stop any evil from being done and does it all the time. But he also doesn't always do it. I mean, there are times when he lets it happen. Now, in the case of Abimelech taking Sarah in his harem, he intended to sleep with her, but God prevented that. God didn't want that to happen, so it didn't. That has nothing to do with Calvinism. Just because a person doesn't accept a Calvinist idea of sovereignty doesn't mean that we deny God's sovereignty. Calvinism's idea of sovereignty is meticulous providence, which means down to the smallest detail, God ordains everything that happens, and it happens only because God ordains it. And anytime you find in the Bible that God, you know, is kind of working behind the scenes and making things happen a good way or a bad way, you know, they say, see, there it is. That's that. There's that meticulous providence. But what they don't realize is that they're reading specific cases. They're not reading universal ideas that somehow every time somebody sins, God makes it happen. Or every time someone decides not to sin, that God made them not do it. But he can. It says in Proverbs 21:1, the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord as the rivers of water. He turns it whithersoever he wants to. And yeah, he does. God turns the hearts of kings whenever he wants to. That doesn't mean every decision a king makes is one that God turned his heart to do that. God is sovereign over the kings, and he can change them or direct them if he chooses. But the Bible does not say he always chooses to, and that everything that's ever happened, I mean, it says in Hosea that Israel, God says, you appointed kings, but not of me. You know, it's not every king that came along was God's doing. But God does raise up kings and take them down when he wants to. The whole issue is not, does God sometimes make things happen? Of course he does. He's very involved in this world and in his people's lives. And the Bible testifies that, including the case you gave there in Genesis 20. But to say God does that is simply a Christian doctrine. It's not a Calvinist doctrine. Calvinism didn't come along until about 400 AD. But Christians, for the first 400 years before that, they believed God works in history. I mean, that's a basic Christian principle. God intervenes when he wants to. The thing about Calvinism is they suggest God's always intervening in everything and that we don't even have real choices in the matter. We appear to have choices, but God is even making the choices for us because nothing can happen without God ordaining it. And when he ordains it, it inevitably will happen. So really, we don't have any agency at all, really. We seem to, but it's just kind of we just appear to, but we don't have any agency. God's just pulling all the strings. All right, I appreciate your call, brother. Let's see, Damien?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so that was your question, right?
Yes, sir, yeah, and super quickly, I remember in a sermon that you had preached, and specifically Romans chapter, Romans chapter 10, verses 14 through 18. You said that you had a hard time with that passage. Have you come to a new understanding about that yet or no?
Well, the hard time I had is not that I have any problem with what it says. I just had a hard time knowing why Paul sticks that in here in the discussion. And basically, that's the place where he's quoted from Joel chapter 2 in verse 13. He says, "Whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved." That's a quotation from Joel 2. And then he says, "How shall they call on him whom they have not heard, believed? How shall they believe in him whom they have not heard? How shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall they preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful on the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace," from Isaiah 52:7, "who bring glad tidings of good things." Now, the question I have is, why did Paul bring this up into the discussion? It seems like sort of a parenthesis or a deviation, which could be all that it is. I'm just always looking for a reason for him including something in his argument. Obviously, what he's saying is true. How can someone hear the gospel if it's not preached to them? You know, that's what he's saying. But why is he bringing that up here? Was somebody suggesting that people shouldn't preach? If so, that doesn't seem to be anything that was a concern in the context. He's talking about Israel and what God's purposes were in his dealings with Israel. And it's kind of like he goes off onto a side issue. Well, you know, they can't call on him if they don't hear, and they can't hear if they're not preached to, and they can't be preached to unless we send them out. As if he's arguing with somebody who was somehow opposed to preaching and he needed to justify it. So I just don't know exactly why he does that. It has occurred to me, but I don't say this is the answer, it's occurred to me that he may be dealing with some people in the congregation who are objecting to him going to the Gentiles, because sometimes the Jews did object to it. And he's writing to a Jewish concern here in chapters 9 through 11. And he may be saying, he may be quoting critics, as he sometimes does in Romans, where he says, you know, how shall they hear if you don't preach them? And this could be a Jewish critic saying to Paul, well, you say that whoever calls on the name of the Lord should be saved, but how can they call him if you don't preach them? And you're preaching to the Gentiles. You should be preaching to your own people, the Jews. But he says, but I say, have they not heard? And he says, they certainly have heard. For Isaiah says, who has believed our report? And he says, the psalm also says, he says in verse 18, about the stars, and they're declaring the glory of God, says their sound has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. So he's arguing that, well, people have heard. And yet he seems a few verses earlier saying, but we need to make sure they hear. We need to send out preachers. And he says, yeah, but have they heard? Yeah, they have heard, he says. Well, then are you talking out of both sides of your mouth? Or is the first part of it the words of critics who are trying to say, Paul, you should be preaching to your Jewish brethren, not to the Gentiles? And he said, well, the Jews have heard. God, you know, God, Isaiah said, to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Who has believed our report? He's talking about Jesus came to the Jews, and they didn't believe him. And more than that, the stars declare the glory of God, according to Psalm 19, verses 1 and 2, which he also quotes here. It's a bit confusing where Paul's going with that, but it's not really, it's not troublesome, except to someone like me who's kind of anal about wanting to see how everything Paul says leads to something else that he says, which leads to something else. I'm always looking for the train of thought. And frankly, Paul sometimes breaks away from his train of thought and kind of gives some asides, and that might be what he's doing here. But anyway, it's not a problem so much as I just don't know exactly how to weave it into his train of thought perfectly. I have some thoughts, but okay. I don't know if I'm right. Okay, thank you, brother. Let's talk to Slavik from South Carolina. Slavik, welcome.
Hi, Steve. I'm about to start on your series, on your teaching series on evangelism. And I just had this thought, this question, I guess. In the New Testament, we see that the most people, whether Jews or pagans, you know, they believed in at least one God or one deity, right? And today, maybe, I don't know, I would say that most people maybe the Western civilization, most people are atheists or agnostics. But would you say that it is a bit harder to evangelize in today's society versus the New Testament society because we are one step removed? We have to convince atheists and agnostics that there is a God, and then after that, tell them what God did through Jesus Christ?
Well, you know, you're right. Atheists have another step to take before they're at the level that most people were at already in the ancient world. In the ancient world, there were no real atheists. I mean, there might be people who had private atheistic beliefs, but everybody was part of some pagan religion or Jewish religion or Christian faith. I mean, that basically there were no secular societies. There were no non-religious societies. Every country had a priesthood and temples to their gods. The idea of a secular society really arose, I think, maybe primarily during the French Revolution, and since maybe no earlier than that. But now, of course, there are many secular democracies, and therefore many people who are not religious particularly. Of course, everyone believes some kind of religious view, because even atheism is a religious concept. It's not an organized religion, but neither is theism. Theism is the belief in God. It's not an organized religion either. It's just believing that there's a God. If you're an atheist or a theist, those are both religious opinions. Those are both opinions about God. One is that there is a God, one there's not a God, but both of them are basically theological propositions, and therefore nobody is without some kind of faith that falls into the category of religion. But I would say we live at a time where atheism has become hip. And although the Bible says the fool has said in his heart there's no God, and anyone who's not an atheist looks on atheism and says, I don't know how people can be that dumb, honestly. But atheists look at us and say, we're the bright ones, we're the brights. You know, we're the smart ones. We're the educated ones. Well, obviously, both sides think the other is kind of stupid. And when you're the Christian trying to convince an atheist and they think you're stupid, and frankly, you think that their views are stupid, there is a bit of a chasm to go across. But the early Christians had to face that too. Not as much with Jews, of course, because the Jews already believed in the same God that Christians did. And also they believed in prophecy and that the Messiah was coming. So reaching Jews was possibly easier, except some of them were more hostile to the gospel. But at least Jews believed there was a Messiah coming, and if the Christians could convince them that Jesus was that Messiah from their own scriptures, that was easy. Talking to pagans was actually pretty easy too, because they all believed in deities, but they even believed in deities that visit humans. So it was possible for Paul and others to, you know, direct their beliefs in the right direction. But it's always hard to reach some people, because men are rebellious against God many times. And, you know, no matter how philosophically close or far they are from you, they just won't receive it. Whereas others will. I'm out of time. I wish I was not. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Everything you need to know is found there. Check it out, thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow.